will say, Rasulullah on that day, even though we've strayed from him and his way. My brothers, my sisters in Islam, let's struggle, work and pray. If we are to bring back the glory of his way. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim.
This is a Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report special. I'm Mimi Rosenberg. Against the beautiful strains of Sami Youssef, the Middle East exploding, the nature and causes of the ever-widening crisis between first Israel and Palestine, and now including Lebanon, with the potential for further escalation in the powder keg we call the Middle East. Already military and civilian casualties are growing on both sides. How did the situation get so out of control so quickly? Is Israel using the relatively minor attacks by its adversaries as an excuse to promote a wider agenda? What is the role of the U.S. in this devolution of the conflict? And an analysis of U.S. and international media reporting on the facts on the ground. We'd like to bring into the discussion Nasir Arori, who is the Chancellor Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth and author of Dishonest Broker, The U.S. Role in Israel and Palestine. But first, we are very pleased to have with us on the line Laila Al-Haddad, who's a journalist based in the U.S. and the Gaza Strip. And Laila, you and I didn't get as much of a chance to speak as I would like to because you were busily rushing to finish an article for the Electronic Intifada. So maybe you can give us a preview of what some of the concerns that you raised in that article were.
Sure. Actually, it was for Le Monde Diplomatique. It was not for Electronic Intifada, although I do write for them frequently, so you are not mistaken in that sense. I was writing basically a sort of contextual piece trying to put the current events in the context of the past of sort of ongoing and systematic Israeli aggressions against Palestinians of the past decade, because I thought it would help people to understand why Palestinians, especially Palestinians in Gaza, are reacting the way they are, why things are unfolding as they are. Because often I'll get the question, yes, but, you know, Israel withdrew from Gaza. Isn't that what you wanted? And yet you continued, as Palestinians, to fire rockets. You continue to complain. And then this latest capture of the soldier. And so the way that many people see it is that Gaza was sort of over and done with, and Palestinians were trying to kind of reignite the flame. So I was trying to explain a little bit about the continuation following the Israeli disengagement last year of the Israeli stranglehold on Palestinian life there, and over Palestinian life in general, of course. And basically, this involves this Israeli matrix of administrative control over every aspect of Palestinian life. And what I mean by that is their control of the travel permit system, amongst other things, so that even after the disengagement, the overwhelming majority of Palestinians in Gaza could not travel to the West Bank, where they had family, where they could attend university, and importantly, where they could get treated there and within Israel in hospitals for treatments that are unavailable in Gaza. And this is very significant, and though it may seem somewhat banal, it demonstrates how the occupation really affects and invades every aspect of Palestinian life, and it renders even routine matters utterly impossible. And I could go on, but maybe I'll give you a chance.
No, actually, it would be helpful if you go on, because I think the empirical description lends
to really examples.
Sure.
Well, I mean, so basically, more basic terms, after the disengagement last summer, in which the Israelis withdrew their troops and settlers from within Gaza, Gaza was still very much a prison. It became this large, as people describe, the largest open-air prison on earth, with maximum security. And though there were no internal barriers, there continued to be these barriers in every shape and form that surrounded us. And the Israelis continued, contrary to their claims, continued to control our airspace, our borders, very importantly, access to people and to goods, and even the only outlet in and out of Gaza, the Rafah crossing. And so what this means is that Palestinians in Gaza, and Gaza had sovereignty, and of course no territorial contiguity with the West Bank, so it's impossible to establish any kind of sustaining entity or state in that way. And so to give examples, I can start with myself. For example, being a resident of Gaza, I travel back and forth between the U.S. and Gaza. I'm not a U.S. citizen. I'm a Palestinian citizen. I have a Palestinian Authority passport. My husband, who is a Palestinian refugee, grew up in camp in Baalbek in Lebanon, which, of course, now is also in the news. He then came and was able to get different scholarships, studied in the U.S. He's now a physician in training, but he still has a refugee document, and he cannot actually either visit or even live with me in Gaza, with me and our son. And that is because even after disengagement, Israel still controls this permit system, which would allow to move in and out of Gaza. So only Palestinians with Israeli-issued permit and travel documents can actually move in and out of Gaza. And so there's literally tens of thousands of Palestinians in a situation that they lack family reunification permits that would enable them as a family to actually live as a unit over there. And so this is one example. It seems so bewildering as to almost be absurd, but it's true. You know, my own husband can't come live with me there, and that's why I go back and forth. There's other cases. My friend and neighbor, you know, she wanted to study in Bir Zeit in Ramallah, which is one of the major universities in the Palestinian territories, and she kept trying and trying, and she got accepted to do her master's there, and she kept getting denied. And this is, you know, a 30-year-old, brilliant, very intelligent young woman, kept getting denied on these blanket security reasons. And it sounds like when you say security, like, oh, well, there must be something there. And 90% of Palestinians in Gaza are denied it, these travel permits based on these blanket security reasons. And so this shows you how extensive the border closure, the blanket border closure and travel ban is on Palestinians. Her neighbor, 45-year-old man, actually went blind while he was waiting for his permit to be issued where he could get treated in a hospital in Jerusalem. So it has much more dire, of course, and fatal consequences in some cases.
Well, I also want to, you know, one of the other things that you had mentioned is the whole question of prisoners.
Yes.
So there's the actual prisoners, and then there is the cordoning off.
Yeah, well, you know, I like to give this example of shortly after the disengagement last summer, I was along the border in Rafah, southern end of Gaza, which had for so long divided Rafah in Gaza from its sister city on the Egyptian side after Israelis imposed that wall there, and it became completely porous for a few days, and I was covering it, and I saw these two young boys, about 9 years old, peering over that wall, and I went and asked them what they were doing, and they said, well, we've never been outside of Rafah before, not even out of Gaza, and we just wanted to get to see what it looks like in the outside world. And then they asked me, do you know what Egyptians look like? So that gives you a little bit of a sense, it was very sobering in a way, of how much of a prison Gaza had become, how secluded it had become, and how because of this just overwhelming control of its borders. And so, yes, sometimes we refer to ourselves there as all inmates in this 350-square-kilometer area smaller than Washington, D.C., because that is the reality. It's very different than any other country or area or territory in that sense, is that it's very difficult, almost impossible for anyone to get in or out. Of course, you're talking about Palestinian prisoners. There's about 9,000 Palestinians, either in administrative detention or prisons in Israel, most without charges or without due process or trial, often abducted from their homes or from their neighborhoods. 380 of them are children, are actually minors under 18, and again, often abducted from their homes and subjected to the same kind of cruel interrogation tactics, position torture, humiliating treatment as others, and there's no distinction between them as children and adults. And they are often kept in administrative detention without charge or trial, and this period of time they're kept in there is renewed time and again under obscure, outdated laws. And there's also over, I think, 150 women in those prisons. And if you were to count the total number of Palestinians that have been in prison since 1967 in Israel, it is something like 20% of the population, 40% if you were to count the men. So it really is quite bewildering.
Afraid we're going to leave this segment there. Laila Al-Haddad, who's a journalist based in the U.S. and the Gaza Strip.
Let's become whole again. Lord again, 'cause I swear with firm belief in our hearts we can bring back the glory of our past. My Ummah, he will say, Rasulullah, that day, even though we've strayed from him and his way. Look at where we were, look at where we are, tell me, is this how he'd wanted to be? Oh no, let's bring back our glory.
And we'd also like to bring into the discussion Nasir Arori, who is the Chancellor Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth and author of Dishonest Broker, The U.S. Role in Israel and Palestine. And Nasir, it's clear that Iran has influence and has armed and trained Hezbollah, but Hezbollah is an indigenous Lebanese group. And we can talk about Iranian-made missiles, but Israel is using U.S.-made missiles. It's crucial to understand why Hezbollah has such an important role in Lebanon, and I was hoping that you could help us parse out some of these issues.
Yes, well, I mean, Hezbollah is basically a mass movement. It's an indigenous movement. It's a grassroots movement. It is a movement that has succeeded together with Hamas in establishing what used to be known during the Vietnam period parallel hierarchy, which means that they have been able to provide social services, educational services. They've been able to provide for the people around them services that governments often are not able to provide, and that is the parallel hierarchies. So they are parallel to the government, not exactly government within a government, but they do have sizable influence. But the important thing is that it is an indigenous Lebanese movement that came out of the need to resist the occupation. I mean, in the beginning of it, let us say after the June 1967 war, it was the Palestinians who were stationed in South Lebanon fighting Israel in order to be able to recover territory and in order to be able to return the refugees. But things developed later on in such a way that a Shiite militia by the name of Amal was doing the resisting in the south. The Palestinians had to be evacuated in 1982 after the invasion. And by that time, Hezbollah was beginning to develop itself into the resistance. And it rose to become actually the sole Lebanese resistance and succeeded in having driven the Israeli occupation out in May of 2000. This is something that disturbs the Israelis. Hence, it has to be labeled as either terrorist, militant, a surrogate of Iran, a surrogate of Syria. I mean, our media and government seem to be quite good at demonizing certain individuals and certain movements and certain countries and people, which is rather racist. And once they associate you with the demons, then you become a fair game. Fair game to the Fox News and sometimes CNN, and to the Israelis as well. But I think that it's a mistaken concept to dismiss Hezbollah as a terrorist group or as just a militant group, but because it is actually a resistance movement, it is an integral part of the Palestinian body politic, and it has succeeded in establishing what I said before, parallel hierarchies. Hamas is in the same position in terms of parallel hierarchies as well, because it caters more actually to the civilian population than the so-called Palestine National Authority, which is not national actually.
Hamas actually seems, as we look at Hamas, to have accepted even the Oslo peace process really, and Hezbollah joined the government of Lebanon. Aren't these organizations, weren't they in the process of really transforming, engaging the process of diplomacy and not merely armed might?
Well, I wish I could say that Hamas was transforming towards the positive. I don't really, but that's my own view. I would have been more comfortable had they not joined the Oslo process, because the Oslo process, I think, has wreaked havoc on the Palestinian people. But be that as it may, Hamas showed an inclination to meet the U.S. and Israel more than halfway. And you're quite right. I mean, the mere fact that they entered the elections, they went into the campaign, and that they won. What kind of elections were they contesting? They were elections to the so-called Legislative Council, which was a product of Oslo. And therefore, the mere fact that they campaigned and were part of the elections puts them on record as having accepted the Oslo process. But it is well known now that Israel is not really, is the one that is not accepting the Oslo process.
You know, one of the things that there has been discussion about was the 1996 and the 1982 wars, and comparisons have been made. And I know you have a number of thoughts on whether this is an effort in many ways to realize the goals of the 1982 war, or perhaps for that matter, even to complete the process of 1948.
Yes, I think that both attacks on Gaza and on Lebanon have been long in the making. And I'm not imagining that, because actually the newspaper Haaretz, which is one of the largest dailies in Israel, reported about 10 days ago in a long, long article detailing the fact that the Attorney General of Israel, it was attributed to him, saying that the attack against Hamas and against Gaza was weeks in the making. The question here is, if both of these attacks were long in the making, and I guess the corporate media in the U.S. have been saying as well that the attack on Hezbollah and Lebanon has been long in the making, the question is why? Why these attacks now? It seems to me that Israel possibly calculated at the level of its general staff and the strategic establishment. They calculated that now the geopolitical position of Israel is not as good as they want it to be, that it has not really improved since 2000, since they were compelled to leave Lebanon, and since 2002, when they attacked the major cities and refugee camps in the West Bank in the spring of 2002. As they look between 2000 and now, they felt that, well, I mean, here in Lebanon, Hezbollah is a respectable political actor. As you said, they are part of the political process, part of the government. Secondly, they look and they see that the so-called Cedar Revolution that came after the assassination of Hariri in Lebanon seems to have fizzled. They look as well and they see that Syria hasn't really been undermined. Iran is on the rise. It's developing a regional policy and hoping to play a prominent role in regional politics, if not beyond. Hamas, like Hezbollah, has become a prominent political actor, winning the elections. And moreover, the U.S. is bogged down in Iraq. All of these actually translate into something of a weakness in the power of deterrence that Israel likes to have. And therefore, this is the time to do it. With regard to, you asked me about 1996 and 1982, both invasions of Lebanon. Well, I am tempted to say that this one looks like 1996, but I would rather think that it may be looking more like 1982, which means that it is more ominous. In 1996, when Shimon Peres was the prime minister, he sent his forces to South Lebanon. Hundreds of thousands of Lebanese became refugees. That was the campaign that was called Grapes of Wrath. And when a little bit over 100 Lebanese were taking shelter in Qana, which is a United Nations compound, a shell came in and killed most of them, more than 100 casualties, all civilians hiding, taking refuge in the UN place. It lasted for 17 days, and then Israel withdrew, and Hezbollah resumed its resistance until they convinced the Israelis to leave in 2000. That's the 1996. But 1982, I think, was much more ambitious in its goals. And it did have three goals. The first goal was to foreclose on the option of a Palestinian independent state. Why am I talking about Palestinian state in Lebanon? Because the infrastructure of a Palestinian state in waiting or in formation was in Lebanon. And the Israeli invasion was calculated to smash that and to foreclose on that option. Well, I can't say that they did it, but they postponed it. I think that they gave it a setback. The second and third objectives were not realized. I mean, if the first one, the foreclosure on the Palestinian state, was somewhat realized or postponed, the other two, which is to redraw the map of Lebanon and to bring about a puppet government in Lebanon that would serve Israeli interests, and the third is reducing Syria's influence to manageable proportions, these were not realized. And it may very well be that Israel is trying to fulfill the second and third goal, which it was not able to fulfill in 1982. That would be, of course, a completion of the process that had begun in Iraq in 2003 with the U.S. invasion at the behest of the neoconservatives and the pro-Israel think tanks in Washington. That then would reshape the entire strategic landscape in the Arab world. It would balkanize the Arab world. It would enable Israel to complete the 1948 war of Palestine. And this is really the grand design that Sharon was pursuing in 82. And it may very well be that Sharon's successor, Olmert, is trying to pursue the same thing. If the Israelis think that they can realize their objectives of 1982 that may have become the objectives of 2006, then we cannot really expect any agreement from Washington to a ceasefire and the beginning of a negotiation. We have seen this in 1967 when Arthur Goldberg was the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. and he was clearly postponing the discussions and even resorting to some sort of filibustering so that he would give Israel a chance to reach the frontiers that Israel considered to be defensible, i.e. the Suez Canal, the Golan Heights, and the Jordan River. I think that we could see something like this today, but only if Israel thinks that they can pull it off. However, if Hezbollah can persist for a while, despite the fact that they lost their command and control, despite the fact that there are no roads left, despite the fact that the borders of the country are sealed, and that is going to perhaps deplete their weapons, if that happens, if the Israelis know it's going to happen, then I think that they would probably keep it going in order to realize their objectives. If not, if the Israelis agree to some sort of stopping the hostilities, then it means that the Israelis realize that Hezbollah probably has a trump card. And what is the trump card? We don't know. It could be something bad from their point of view. Be that as it may, I think at the end of the day, we have to ask another question, and that is, what does it take really to bring about a permanent settlement that is not going to postpone the conflict, but it's going to end it for once and all? I mean, after all, the United States has been engaged in what it calls wrongly the peace process for four decades. And you just look at every single administration since Nixon, and you find that there is a peace plan called the peace plan introduced by the U.S., named after every president and or every secretary of state, from Nixon all the way to the present. Except when it came to Bush, he decided that Israel unilateralism is the best way, and let Israel really do this, and we're not going to have a Bush plan. Although he might tell you his plan is the Palestinian state. I think that these plans, and I tried to show this in Dishonest Broker, my book that was mentioned there, I think that these plans were probably never meant for implementation. So unless we have a different formula, a different format, a different venue, something like a peace conference where all UN resolutions can be put on the table, where all concerned parties can be invited, there's not going to be a peace, because I think that the U.S. cannot be allowed to be Israel's bankroller, chief diplomatic supporter, and arms supplier, and at the same time, honest broker. That has to happen. I think the U.S. bears a good deal of responsibility, great responsibility, for the tremendous loss of civilian lives and the obscene loss of property in Lebanon, for the simple reason that all these years, for four decades, not only did it not bring about peace, although it saw itself as the peacemaker, but it also prevented third parties and elbowed out anyone who was going to come as a mediator. And that's a great responsibility.
Nasir Arori is the Chancellor Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth, and author of, which I encourage everybody to read, an extremely important book, Dishonest Broker, The U.S. Role in Israel and Palestine. And I thank you for joining us.
This has been a Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report special. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
My Ummah, my Ummah, he will say, Rasulullah, even though we've strayed from him and his way. Look at where we were, look at where we are, tell me, is this how he'd wanted to be? Oh no, let's bring back our glory. Ya Allah, Ya Rabbal Alameen, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the Ummah rise again, let us see daylight again, once again.